The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Max Rushton. Welcome to Football Weekly. Jimbo is doing the world's strongest man. Producer Ben tried to put Dave Farrar, but accidentally got me because all reserve James Richardsons look the same. On today's pod, we'll discuss poor Andre Mariner, sad Arsene Wenger, angry then happy Tim Sherwood, just happy Brendan Rodgers, and very temporarily happy David Moyes. Plus happy Barcelona, sad Pepe rolling around again, and anything else that might be important or happy or sad. On today's panel, serious football broadcaster, radio's back. Barry Glendening.
Hello.
Hi, Radio's Barry Glendening. How are you?
Hello, Radio's Max Rushton.
Yeah, nice to see
and
you.
And TV's Max Rushton and movies.
It's been
silver
so long.
Screens, Max Rushton.
Look, when I do this, I get criticised on the blog for being self-indulgent, and you're doing it for me. That's not fair, is it? Norwich's and Culture's Paul McGuinness.
Hi there.
Are you well?
I was going to say, it's almost like you planned it that way to make Barry your little dupe so he says all the nice things about you so you don't have to say it. I got your game, Rushton.
And we've never met, but producer Ben describes you, Paul, as Heavy Metal's Paul Doyle. Are you happy with that?
That'll do. I've been calmed much worse.
Okay, good. Right, I was at Wembley yesterday. Who would like to talk about Cambridge United's glorious victory 4-0 in the FA Trophy over Gosport? Okay, Chelsea 6, Arsenal 0. We've got to start with Andre Mariner. Poor fella, head in hands. Paul Mack, what did you make of it?
It's calamitous. I mean, I just can't see any excuse, any explanation, and all theories tend towards the he was unable to tell people apart, and that is, you know, it's embarrassing. I wouldn't like to say any more. It's just embarrassing.
Does the statement that came out yesterday from the referee's body does that hold any weight? Mistaken identity is very rare. And it can be because of a number of technical factors.
But that's quite interesting, because if it was indeed a technical error, as they're suggesting, that opens up the intriguing possibility of declaring a replay, which they can do if a referee commits a technical error during
the
game.
Right?
So give Arsene another chance.
That would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Do you think he'd set up the team in exactly the same way again?
He might do.
This time we will outpass Chelsea.
But it seemed to me like he didn't see what happened, because he gives a corner, Barry, and then was it the linesman that told him? Or did someone tell him in his ear, hey, that's a handball, but forgot to tell him it wasn't the guy he sent off?
Well, he had a...
I thought lots of people were telling him it wasn't the guy he sent off.
Well, the ox was obviously telling him. Everybody was telling him.
He seemed to have a perfect view, but it was slightly odd in that he kind of went to give a goal kick, or was it a corner, and then... as if someone told him in his over his earpiece that no, it's a penalty, and then told him to send off Kieran Gibbs. And they haven't really explained themselves very well, because I don't think he reached the decision to send off Gibbs himself. I think it may have come from elsewhere, and if it did, the question is who told him to send off Kieran Gibbs?
He probably didn't see that there'd been a handball, I think, which is why he didn't record who it was who did it. So when he was told it was a handball, he then backplayed it and said, oh, well, it must have been the left back. He's more likely to be on the line than a midfielder. It's the only explanation.
Well, that's not really paying much attention to events as they pass them.
No,
is it?
It's not.
I mean, it's quite clear.
It's a technical error.
Well.
But there's a conspiracy there, isn't there, that he is told. A bit like everyone thinks the ref was told about Zidane's headbutt, weren't they? He didn't see it, and then he sent him off because someone must have told him. So... do we think this happens all the time?
Well, I think that's part. It's encouraged, isn't it? I mean, that's part of why you have an official standing behind the line, and why they're all mic'd up so they can communicate with each other and make better decisions. But they made a worse decision as a result of chatting with each other, which is the problem.
Would it have been better if the Ox and Kieran Gibbs had just sat on the floor and said, listen, we're doing you a favour, Andre, by making this awkward now, and it'll be less awkward later?
Well... the ref can't really take the player's word for it. Like, if Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain says to him, it was me, as he did twice, I think, you know, who's to say that he's telling the truth? Obviously, he was telling the truth, and I'm not accusing him of a liar, but it sort of leaves the system open to abuse further down the line, because players will go, you know, inferior players will take bullets for vastly superior.
You've got to think very quickly about who's. I mean, Kieran Gibbs wasn't having a great game, but you've got to think very quickly then.
But isn't there a system? I think it might be in the Bundesliga, where the referee isn't sure, he can ask a player, and if it subsequently after the match emerges that the player lied to him, his punishment is that much more severe.
Oh, okay, that sounds like a feasible idea. And then people have also been calling for the fourth official to have a monitor, and they can relay the pertinent information to the ref. But I think they used to have monitors and they got rid of them because managers were coming over and looking over the fourth official's shoulders to see what had happened in various incidents and then kicking off whenever the ref got one wrong.
But it's a ridiculous situation when everybody in the ground knows what's happened because everyone's got Twitter on their phone and everybody knows it. And the ref must be told a second later. The video technology debate is not fascinating.
No, and I
think it will happen eventually, won't it?
It will, but it will also go down a route towards lots of nitpicking and lots of decisions which, to my mind, in normal play should be allowed to just continue, but because there's been a tiny bit of contact or there's been this or there's been that, people will get pulled up on video evidence, or if they don't pull it up, they'll get pulled up by somebody else for not looking at the video evidence properly. I just think it's going to disrupt the flow and enjoyment.
Yeah, I don't think that should happen. I don't see it doesn't have to disrupt the flow because you can just apply the system they use in American football where they throw a flag on the play. So play can continue. And then when there's a natural break in the play, as there are many in football, then you review it.
Yeah,
so you don't actually have to stop a guy running down the wing.
It's a disingenuous argument to say, well, if there's a goal later, well, then it doesn't matter because there was something that happened before that meant the play should have stopped. Just so you know, we're recording this at a time when we don't know what's happened to Andre Mariner, and by the time you listen to it, we'll probably know what's happened to Andre Mariner.
Well, I think he's due to find out this morning, Monday morning, whether or not he'll be stood down for next week. I think one former ref has called for him to be stood down for the rest of the season, which seems a bit harsh, but I think what's also been lost in all of this is that the fact that neither player should have been sent off because it wasn't a red card offence. The Oxlade-Chamberlain didn't prevent a clear goal scoring opportunity, so assuming the red card is moved on to him or transferred to him, he should probably appeal and will get it overturned, I'd imagine.
I wouldn't let him off on those grounds for the same reason that if you swing a punch at someone but don't connect, you should still be sent off. You know, he thought he was denying a clear goal scoring chance. That's why he did it.
I know that, but just going with the letter of the law it's not a sending
off.
Why
did he even think he was denying a goal scoring chance as well? Because, I mean, the swerve was quite distinctly away from the goal.
More to the point, sometime. What's he doing? It's not like, you know, it's someone shouts spider keepers, jumpers with goalposts, and then they're suddenly in goal. You can't do no idea what he was doing. The best advice for Andre Mariner that he should have just never, ever blown for half-time. Then he would never have to deal with it. They'd still be playing. Just carry on. There is a danger, we thought there'd be a danger that it would overshadow the fact that Arsenal really weren't very good anyway. And it has kind of done that, but Wenger came out and said, look, it was my fault, I take responsibility. Is this Arsenal being rubbish or Chelsea being good? Somewhere in between?
It's obviously a combination of the two, but I think you look at... You would know that Mourinho would do what he did, which was to put out as big and as strong and as direct a midfield as he could to counteract all the dwarves in the Arsenal side. And it worked, you know, it worked from minute five and it worked throughout the game. And for... As many people have said already, for Arsenal to have taken a battering against Liverpool like they did only a few weeks ago and not to have learnt anything from that either suggests naivety, which you couldn't really accuse Wenger of, or just myopia, or unwillingness to consider other options, which is perhaps more of an indictment. And that result on Saturday basically vindicated everything that all the critics of Arsenal have been saying all season.
Yeah, I mean, they've been slaughtered away at City, at Liverpool, and now at Chelsea. They've conceded, I think, 17 goals in those three games alone, and Saturday's must have been possibly the worst performance in Arsenal history, maybe. I mean,
is it the worst birthday ever for anyone?
I think so. They just looked completely psychologically overwhelmed, and the number of individual errors, players giving the ball away, misplacing passes, it was goalkeeping errors, just, you know, you could excuse one performance like that, as you know, and just say it's a one-off. We all have bad days at the office, but to do it three times in one season is pretty unforgivable.
Is what you're saying?
I think it's indicative of a sort of very deep-rooted problem.
Are you saying Wenger out, Barry?
No, I'm not. I don't think he should be fired. I think they could consider replacing him. I mean, because it's getting pretty clear that they're not going to win a title if they continue as they are under him.
But it's intriguing what's going on at Arsenal at the moment, because, of course, the board expected Arsene Wenger to have signed a new contract by now, which he hasn't done. We're not 100% sure why he hasn't done it yet. It's like he wants reassurances over the level of investment he will be allowed to make in the squad. He was very clear at his press conference on Friday, where he held forth at length about his career up to the 1,000th game, and he was clear that we're now entering the third era, you know, the second era being this period of austerity when he had to tighten his belt, and considers it to have been a great achievement just to have consistently reached the Champions League. This now, he says, we're out of that. This is where we're supposed to push on and compete financially with all these other clubs, which they completely failed to do in January, and their inactivity in January was another part of the reason for their poor performance on Saturday. They were missing key players, and their squad wasn't deep enough to withstand that. So was that because the money wasn't in fact made available in January, or was it down to incompetence in the recruitment? They just weren't able to spend it.
And I think if you look at that central midfield of Arteta and Oxlade-Chamberlain, which was comprehensively overwhelmed, you start to think about, well, when was the last time that Wenger made a sensible purchase in that area? And then that starts making you think about other areas of the pitch where there's clearly they have had a need for some time since, say, Patrick Vieira left. They need somebody who's tall and strong and can physically dominate that area. The closest they've ever got is Alex Song, and he wasn't quite right either. But he's got this system where he's got two very capable ball players sitting at the base of the team, but they don't have that strength. And almost every other team at the top of the league has that player in there.
Where does this result put Chelsea?
Top of the table.
Are they favourites now? Are they on top of the table? Obviously, yes. Thanks, Barry.
Still favourites.
Yeah, I think they are favourites because. One of the intriguing parts of this season is that every team has shortcomings, and Chelsea's main two going into the season was their lack of a top-notch centre forward and the void in central midfield, which Mourinho, unlike Wenger, addressed immediately in January with Matic. And in terms of their centre forward, Eto'o is playing really well at the moment, so they're looking strong. The match at Anfield will be intriguing.
Yeah, well, we'll look at Liverpool and City in a moment. Yesterday, Spurs come back. Means they're not a million miles away from Arsenal now. Paul, you were at that game. How was it?
Yeah, it was kind of a summary of the last 4 months at Tottenham. There was some very encouraging moments mixed in with absolute cluelessness, and you're left a little bit undecided as to where they're going. In the first half an hour, Southampton were what Tottenham weren't. They were a slick team in which... very talented individuals all flourished and interacted very well, and they went two goals up and looked like they could win by even more. But then, in fairness to Sherwood, he changed things at half-time and got a hold of central midfield, where Southampton missed Schneiderlin and Wanyama, particularly Schneiderlin, I think. And Southampton faded pretty badly, as they've tended to do in recent weeks. Even Norwich almost came back last week.
Almost, Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just doing a little jig there.
Amy Lawrence wrote a piece about how Eriksen and Soldado looked like they were getting a partnership together. Is that something you spotted as well?
Yeah, they did. Soldado played really well. At first, they were playing a lot of high balls, and that's where the omission or the absence of Adebayor was telling. But when they started playing it to Soldado on the deck, he showed real strength and intelligence in the way he served as a fulcrum. And he did interact well with Eriksen, and so did Nasser Chadli, who's become very influential in recent weeks. And he and Eriksen swapped positions a lot. And both benefit from it.
I guess it's difficult when Adebayor comes back, you know, who gives way? Because you want to play Eriksen in that number 10 role, but then you want to play two up top as well.
Yeah, I guess it will depend on the opposition, and depend. It's good that they have options there now, where once they didn't have one decent striker, it seemed.
For all their good players, and Pochettino's sort of lauded as a bright, young, up-and-coming manager, Southampton are still 24 points off the top of the table. Is that, in your opinion, a far worse position than they should be in, or is it about par, do you reckon?
I think injuries have afflicted them pretty hard this term. As I said on Saturday, Schneiderlin and Wanyama, they're two powerful players in midfield, were missing, and they've had a lot of players missing throughout the season at various points, and often that's been offset by the emergence of really good young players who've come into the fold. But where you could really criticise them for not doing as well as they should was, of course, in the FA Cup, where they kind of threw in the towel there mysteriously.
And I think in a glass half full capacity, I'd say, look, they're still 8 points clear of 10th. And they are in this tiniest of mini leagues with Newcastle, where they're stranded in between two parts. But for a club who was only promoted the season before last, absolutely no relegation worries have been safe for a long time.
You happy with those answers, Barry?
I am very happy.
Good news. Right,
tell you what, yeah. I'll give you 30 seconds to tell us about Cambridge United's win over Gosport Borough.
Do you know what?
Or Gosport Borough, even.
Yeah, well, that we've...
You were talking down...
I interviewed the chairman of Gosport
chairman yesterday on our radio show.
It's very rare as a Cambridge fan to patronise any other football fan, but I kind of did accidentally. It was weird because we obviously had to win because they're a division below us, but they're bottom of their division. We're second in ours. So we just sort of, it was weird going to a game thinking, well, we just should win this. So it actually took away from the joy of, you know, upsetting teams, which is what you normally do as a Cambridge fan. But still, lovely day. Went 4-0. I had Kevin Roberts, who was our old captain, is a Scouser, and basically his entire family had bought one ticket and were all sitting on one chair. There were like 15 of them, and they were hammered. But they were, and he was on the bench, and all that happened was he was running up the line. They were going, Robbo, Robbo, and then Cambridge bought on one sub, and it wasn't Kevin Roberts, and they were a bit disappointed. And they bought on a second sub, and it wasn't Kevin Roberts, and they were a bit disappointed. And at 85 minutes, there are two subs warming up, and one was Kevin Roberts. And the manager, Richard Money, pointed at them both, and they ran back. They both ran back to the dugout at Wembley, and then you could see the other guy, Tom Bonner, taking his kit off to go on, and Kevin Roberts' family were very upset. And then we discovered behind us, as the people behind us started cheering, that they were Tom Bonner's family. and we were in between what could have been a war between the Roberts and the Bonners. But 4-0, very happy. Right, Liverpool thumped Cardiff. Right, did you see Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's post-match interview where, at the end of it, they said, do you think Liverpool are title contenders? And he just went, I couldn't care less, and walked off. I don't know if you echo those sentiments, but it would be disappointing if you all three said you didn't care less and then walked off. Liverpool, I mean, they're definitely in contention. They've scored the most goals, and producer Ben says that for the last 5 years, the team who scored the most goals have won the title. They're on 82, City 76, and Chelsea a mere 62, even though they scored six at the weekend. Where do you put Liverpool?
I do think they're genuine contenders. They are slightly ropey at the back, as everyone knows, which may stand against them. But, I mean, if you're conceding three, it doesn't really matter if you bang in six at the other end.
Good little observation made today someplace that basically they've conceded 12 goals all season at home. And there are three away games remaining, one of which is against Norwich. I think there might be away at Sunderland. Or it basically three bottom half teams who they might hope to outscore, even if their defending was dodgy, but actually at home they're a lot tighter, which, you know, could make a difference.
Do all the neutrals want Liverpool to win the league?
Quite a lot do, don't they? I don't quite understand why years of antipathy towards them has fallen away, but it is a good narrative. They've come from nowhere and they're playing great football.
And the alternative is Mourinho winning it.
Yeah, well, that's true. But you don't see many people rooting for City in the middle, do you, or anything? But yeah, I mean, Mourinho winning it, cool, blimey.
Cardiff, second bottom. They did score three. Anything that's positive, if anything?
Yeah, they looked... I mean, you know, they three different goals. They capitalised on the spaces left by a slightly unorthodox formation from Rodgers. But they were sharp. You know, Fraser Campbell's goal was very well taken, as was much his first. And there was even an involvement with Kevin Jones in the third. But, yeah, you wonder, up against teams who are going to play a little bit more structured against them, They've got to win. They've got to win, and they've got a winner. Don't see it.
I mean, Liverpool have Sunderland on Wednesday night at home. I can't see Sunderland getting 3 goals against them. I can certainly see Liverpool getting 6 or more.
Part 3 is the big Premier League preview, Barry, just so you know.
Oh, I do apologise.
So, no, it's fine.
I wasn't aware of that we actually had a format.
I think
set in stone.
I've written some stuff. You said the alternative to Liverpool is Jose or Pellegrini, perhaps. And that was the most inevitable win of the season. Even Di Michele scored.
It's funny, isn't it? You do sometimes watch them and think they need an inspired performance by one of their individuals to make a convincing victory. Now, they've obviously got a great squad, they've got a great team ethic, but they do seem a little bit more reliant on a like Silva the previous weekend or Yaya Toure this weekend, like dragging the team along. Obviously, they've had Aguero to do that for them for a long part of the season. They don't have him now. They're without company. I think while it happened to Chelsea only a week ago, I think I'm always more suspicious that City might chuck a rick at some point.
Manchester United have won 2 on the bounce. Moyes the saviour, isn't it? I mean, every bubble that David Moyes has... Does he blow the bubble that bursts, or does the bubble just grow organically? I don't know, but any time a bubble has started to grow around Man United, it's burst very, very quickly, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reaction to their win over Olympiacos was a bit hysterical. Admittedly, it was a good result, but Olympiacos are kind of second-rate European opposition. Although Manchester United, some might say, are also second-rate European opposition at this stage. But, decent win over West Ham, and the kind of win that used to be routine under Lord Ferg and is seen as a huge turning point now with David Moyes at the helm.
Even in that game, once they got their first goal, they were under pressure, quite considerable pressure, without creating any distinct chances for another 15, 20 minutes. And United, they still have this. They have a vulnerability, both physically, I think, but also psychologically, in the way that Fergie gets one goal, he'll go and get his teams will go and actively hunt for a second until they got it, and then 3, etc. They'd never stop attacking, and there was a bit of a retreating back into the shell that you saw from United. I don't think they're fully healed by any means.
They've got more points away from home than any other team in the Premier League.
Is that true?
Yeah. That interesting
good
statistic, yeah. But they're not very good at Old Trafford, and Manchester City go there on Tuesday. This is the only game we're previewing in part one, just, you know, Barry, for the running order.
Right, okay.
Is that written down, or are you ad-libbing that?
That statistic?
No, the previewing one preview.
And I've got that here, though, that we're previewing the Manchester Derby right now, yeah.
Okay.
I wrote it down.
Because you've either got a structure or you haven't. Yeah, okay. You can't jazz
well, I've,
one.
I've been,
you can't play fast and loose with the structure. Just swat in.
It seemed the right time to bring it up.
Just because Dave Ferrar wasn't available. You swat in, you make a structure, then you change it.
Do you want to hear some feedback when there was announced? When it was announced that it was me and not Dave Ferrar, Blue Dylan said, "I'm sure Max is a nice fella and all that, but Dave Ferrar is so much better at hosting in James' absence. Please get Dave back. He knows about football and everything. He even knows foreign players." And in response, Al Jazeera, it's an official response from Al Jazeera, who I'm sure might employ me one day when everyone else fires me. "I don't mind Max. Dave is better, but I think Max has improved a lot over time."
That's an official Al Jazeera from the Al Jazeera account.
Well, I hope so.
He's brilliant.
Damn, it's given to me by producer Ben. So look, can Manchester United beat Man City? How do they do it?
I think they have to hope Manchester City turn in a very poor performance for a start. And beyond that, I mean, their confidence is going to be quite high after 2 wins in a row. And yeah.
Well, City have been defensively dodgy all season, so there's always hope for any opposition against them. I know Kompany is back, but Kompany has made plenty of mistakes this season as well.
He's got another stat. Yeah, more clean sheets when Di Michaelis has played than Kompany.
That's right.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things about their solidity the last couple of games has been that they haven't had to press as high or push their defensive line as high up, and therefore not left Di Michaelis as exposed to balls through. So I guess that's what United, that's their best hope, is getting, I don't know, as much pace up front, Young or Januzaj, or trying to get Rooney running past the last defender.
Okay, good. Well, look, that seems like... Oh, do you want to say something, Barry?
Well, I was just wondering, is there any part in your structure for us to have the debate over whose goal was better, Wayne Rooney's or David Beckham's?
I was going to wait until we talk about Norwich in part 3, then I'd bring up that and Rooney's goal and decide which was better.
Okay.
Are you happy with that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a tease, isn't it, to keep listening. That is it for part one. In part two, my lack of European football knowledge is cruelly exposed again, giving great ammunition for the more cosmopolitan members of the pod blog community. I won't let you down. Welcome to part two. Let's start in Spain. Barcelona won El Clasico 4-3, a hat-trick from Messi. Three penalties, one red card. That result means that there's 1 point between the top three. Atletico Madrid atop, same number of points as Real Madrid, 70. Barcelona have 69 points. Sid Lowe is in Spain. Hello, Sid.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm very well. You were at El Clasico. How was it?
Breathless. And it was an absolute nightmare from the point of view of a match report, which is always a sign of a really good game. I think it was probably the best Clasico I've seen. I'm writing about it at the moment, and it occurred to me that one way of looking at this is that a Barcelona player once said to me that it's the game of the century, even if there's eight of them a year. And of course, that comment was based as much as on the excellence of these two teams, also on that sense of expectation and the way it's always hyped up. And of course, with the fact that they play each other so often now, because they're dominating the Copa del Rey, because they've met in the Champions League, because they tend to play the Supercopa, that it almost feels a bit diluted. Last night, it might actually have been true. I've actually been sad enough to go through and write down every single Clasico that's been played this century. And I think this might be the best of them.
Do you want to read out the whole list to us?
It will bore you to tears, but I can pick a few really good ones out for you.
Producer Ben says no.
Oh, Producer Ben, how could he?
Did Barcelona deserve it?
I sort of don't know. It was one of those games where they both had lots of chances, and if either team had won, I'd probably say yes, they deserved it. So seeing as Barcelona did win, I'm going to say yes, they deserved it. I thought Barcelona were excellent in the way they tried to keep the ball. They did concede a reasonable amount of chances, particularly in the first half when Angel Di Maria was brilliant, but Messi was absolutely outstanding. And I suppose from Messi's point of view, enough of times look around and think, oh, you know what, if we had a defence, we'd be really good.
Is Pepe okay after he got he got slightly brushed, didn't he, by Fabregas? They both almost died after the penalty.
Pepe is I've got to the point where I almost like Pepe now, because he's such a pantomime villain, and he seems to be fine. He seems to recover from that. However, it is worth pointing out, actually, there's a photo in the Spanish media this morning, which I think actually is a Reuters photo, which obviously has then been distributed to the rest of the Spanish media, of Busquets appearing to stand on Pepe's head. So if he wasn't hurt by the sort of head lean butt thing, whatever you want to call it, because it wasn't a proper head butt, was it? If he wasn't hurt by that, he might have been hurt by Busquets standing on him. Although the picture's not 100% conclusive, although it does look pretty damning.
Well, presumably Busquets would have broken his leg when that happened anyway, because he goes down relatively easily.
They say they've been rolling around on the floor, the pair of them. Yeah, actually, the one player who went down that really was a bit freaky was after the first Real Madrid guy, Angel Di Maria, provides the assist. But the players are walking back to halfway line, he suddenly just kind of falls on the floor. And they kind of came running over, and then about 2 minutes later, he was creating the second, so he was fine. But he played brilliantly, but say Messi was absolutely sensational.
Is Neymar okay after he was cynically scythed down by Ramos for his now 19th red card for Real Madrid?
Well, Neymar,
did he touch him?
I don't know. I've watched it again and again and again, and there's two possibilities. I think one is a clip at ankle height, and the other is perhaps an arm across his shoulder. I just don't know. I've watched it back so many times, I don't know. And I think certainly from the position the referee was in, it would have probably looked like a pretty clear penalty. If Neymar did dive, then it's a bizarre dive as well, because he really is one-on-one with the keeper. He's away from Ramos. So that makes me think there probably was some contact, which then he almost certainly would have made the most of. But it's hard to believe that he'd actually invent that, because as I say, it was such a clear chance. I'm just not sure you would, but maybe I'm a bit too honest.
Like every ignorant English football broadcaster, I need a compulsory Gareth Bale question. He didn't play very well.
He had two very good runs, and one of them ended with a nice assist for Benzema, which brought a save off Valdes. But I felt that both him and Cristiano Ronaldo, and to some extent Neymar, were relatively peripheral figures. You know, the standout players for me, despite missing a couple of good chances, Karim Benzema and Angel Di Maria in the Real Madrid side, Leo Messi, and perhaps you'd argue Andres Iniesta and or Xavi Hernandez, who I thought had a very good game in the Barcelona team. Bale was a little bit peripheral, but so he almost had a really big impact with a really nice assist for Benzema.
Sid, Cristiano Ronaldo has been peddling conspiracy theories, saying that there are dark forces who didn't want Real Madrid to win that game last night. Is there any truth to those, or is he just being a bit paranoid?
No, it's embarrassing, isn't it? Both him and Sergio Ramos did it last night. Actually, Ronaldo's comments were quite funny because he talked about... he did do the conspiratorial thing, but he also did a kind of a... almost, I don't know what you'd call it, really. I suppose a psychological analysis of the referee. But it was great because he said that the referee looked a bit too white to him. And obviously, too white meaning a Real Madrid fan. But what he meant was that he thought the referee looked pallid, that he didn't have the personality for a game like this. And I would have thought that, actually, in a funny sort of way, right or wrong, the referee demonstrated he did have personality, sending off a Real Madrid player at the Bernabeu, giving two penalties against them. I think if you go through the three penalties, and I must confess, during the game, sitting where I was sitting to write the match report, all three penalties looked probably right to me. As it turns out, I've got a relatively big doubt on the Neymar one, but it just doesn't feel plausible to me that he would dive in that position.
Yeah, Ronaldo was outside the box, wasn't he?
Ronaldo was outside the box. Yeah. So two of the three penalties, and the Iniesta one for me is clear. The two of the three penalties aren't, or might not be, but it's one for each side. The big difference, I suppose, comes with the fact that Ramos was sent off. And I think even if Ramos had fouled Neymar, sending off might have been harsh because it certainly didn't look deliberate. You know, it might have been, as I say, a little tap around the ankle or perhaps a slight brush of the arm on the shoulder. Ramos is now already was the most sent off player in Real Madrid's history, and I think that's the thing they're looking at. I suppose from Ronaldo's point of view, what he was saying is everyone wanted a league title with three teams in it, and if we'd beaten Barcelona, they'd have been out of it. So now when they're back in it, I'm not having that, to be honest.
Quickly, Sid, because Paul Mack wants to hurry us on because he's got an important meeting to go to. Roberto Martinez to Barcelona, Sid.
I don't know. You've caught me on the hop there. I don't see any reason why I would expect it to happen. He's very, very well liked in Spain, by the way, and I think he is seen as someone who plays the kind of style that's embraced here. He is, of course, a Catalan. I mean, one of the reasons why he had Deulofeu was because Barcelona trusted him to kind of bring Deulofeu through, playing a kind of football that would suit them, but at the same time, giving him I know it's a cliche, but sod it, I'm going to say it anyway, a touch of that kind of English aggression and an edge and an ability to withstand a quicker game. But I don't really see it, although I'd quite like to see it personally, but I don't see it.
All right, Sid, I think that's probably enough. You know, Paul's looking at his watch, just saying, I've got to get on.
Paul is not looking at his watch. Paul is very calm.
Oh, yeah, Sid, I've got a question. Yeah, at the end, if it's all level, is it goal difference head-to-head or
head-to-head
hair quality?
No, it's head-to-head, which is why Atletico are top now, because their head-to-head record over Real Madrid is better. They've got that advantage, one win and one draw. Real Madrid have also got a disadvantage when it comes to head-to-head against Barcelona, because they've been beaten both times by Barcelona. And that's the big question now being asked about Real Madrid, despite the fact that I personally think Ancelotti's handled things really, really well. Of course, people are saying, well, what about the big games? Not beaten either of these two, didn't win in Italy against Juventus. And it makes me think, here's a scenario for you.
Okay.
Final day of the season, Atletico Madrid go to Barcelona. Now, what happens if those two teams who hate Real Madrid know that a draw gives Real Madrid the league, but a win gives them the league and not Real Madrid, and with 2 minutes to go, it's 1-1. What do they do?
Those dark forces.
That'd be a little bit... Maybe the players won't be, but I'm sure the fans would be thinking, I'll just score an own goal, will you? Let's end this now.
Sid, I want 2 one-word answers from you, if that's possible.
Go on, then.
Who's happier out of Barcelona and Atletico in that Champions League draw?
Barcelona.
And are Real very happy about Dortmund?
Delighted.
I admire the way that Sid managed to draw out even a one word and make it seem
right.
Interminable.
Should we have a little look at the Champions League draw, given that you haven't discussed it yet because it was on Friday? Specifically, the English clubs, Manchester United, they were 20-1. They got drawn against Bayern. They're now 28-1.
That says it all, doesn't it? The collective wisdom of the bookmaker there.
Any chance? I put a fiver on them at 20-1. Is that stupid?
To win the tournament, Jeff?
Yeah.
Why did you do
it's
that?
It's just, there's just a little part of me just thinks they just might spawn it just somehow. Just keep on just randomly, you know, Fellaini will suddenly score a goal.
Well.
And just some weird
it'd
way.
They'd have to be in the game for long enough for one moment of fluke to make a difference, which I struggle to believe.
I mean, if it was a series of one-legged affairs, then you could conceivably imagine them spawning their way to victory, but over two legs, I can't see them.
You mean a series of one-legged affairs, the opponents have to play with just one leg and hop around the field?
I was thinking a series of one-legged affairs is a weird sorted game.
How did you find out about that?
Chelsea at PSG, Paul Doyle.
That's an interesting one. And one where the ineligibility of Matic could prove costly, because PSG have a wonderful midfield trio of Verratti, Matuidi and Kabay or Thiago Motta, and they're really very good and possibly the strongest unit within that team, although Ibrahimovic and Cavani tend to get all the glamour headlines. So that's a very difficult one to call. Good game to watch.
Who is excited by the Europa League draw?
I haven't actually seen it.
Do you want me to tell you?
Yes.
Alkmaar versus Benfica, Basel Valencia, Porto Sevilla and Lyon Juventus.
They're all big sides. There's a Champions League clashes, you know, most seasons.
The Europa League will be better next year when the Champions League aren't allowed in it, if you are rubbish in the Champions League, and if you win it, you get a place in the Champions League. So this is the last year where the Europa League is something you don't want to be in, as far as I can tell. That is it for part two. Did you enjoy part two, everyone?
Yes, although I thought it was a slight step down from part one.
Okay. Did you enjoy that part, though, despite that?
That was a lot of fun.
Okay. Barry, I'm not going to ask you. In part three, we look at the bottom of the Premier League, look ahead to Tuesday and Wednesday night's fixtures as described in the structure, and answer your questions if we've been sent any good ones. Welcome to part three, the final part of the Guardian Football Weekly for today. We're going to do it in 10 minutes because of Paul Mack's meeting. Right, going back to the Premier League, Everton, challenging for Europe. They'd be annoyed that we haven't discussed them yet because we looked at the top of the league. They're 2 points behind Spurs, 2 games in hand, but they do have a very tough run in. How well has Roberto Martinez done, Paul McInnes?
Well, he's done, I think he has done very well. I think you can't underestimate how important it is for fans to go and enjoy watching their team play, and I think that all Everton fans would concur that they've enjoyed this season more than most under Moyes. The fact of the matter is, though, that they're not going to be difficult for them with their running to do any better than they've done under Moyes, and it will probably be, I think you read Martinez's post-match comments, he seems to be talking about Europa League rather than Champions League, and how this will be a step on and a good chapter of development for the club, and I think it would be. But you know, 6 weeks ago they were playing exciting football and looked like they could be in the shake-up for the top four, and obviously that I don't think that's the case anymore.
Barry, a Sunderland fan, you lost 2-0 at Norwich. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the Gus bus? The wheels are nowhere near the bus anymore.
The wheels are bouncing down a nearby hill. Not a huge surprise. Sunderland didn't play very well, not scoring goals. Tetty scored what our regular guest Ian McIntosh would call a thunder bastard of a goal. Unstoppable, but, you know, no one in a Sunderland shirt seemed to try and even block it. And, yeah, the only hope, I think, is that there will be three teams worse than them, and there may well be, but, you know, they're... After the good performance in the Capital One Cup final, I was full of optimism, which is now drained away. And I suppose it sort of says a lot that arguably their best performance of the season, they still lost 3-1 in that Capital One Cup final.
Paul Mack, you'll be biased, won't you? But Alex Tete, goal of the weekend, or not as good as Rooney's? Or Yaya Touré's, that's the third, isn't it?
Yaya Touré's is nice, but it's well within his skill set, I think, to do that.
Okay.
And he has more time, and he's got the ball on the ground. Tete's is more powerful, and you know, he has to take it on the volley. But I think there's something about Rooney's, with just the ease in which he swivels, the time in which he's got to make it, and the way in which he delivers it perfectly. To my mind, I know everybody thinks the goalkeeping was a bit of a joke, and
he was spinning around.
Yeah, I just think it's difficult to. It's a very difficult thing to do when you're kind of trying to track back and watch it over your head. And in the end, I think he realised he wasn't going to get it. So I'd probably go actually Rooney. But I just want to say that our performance on Saturday was excellent, and then the next day, Villa, who tore us apart a couple of weeks ago, had an absolute abomination of a home performance against Stoke. And it's just what really strikes me is about how 11 of the teams in the league can, on their day, be all right, and on their off day, be absolutely dreadful.
Paul Doyle, Barry and I were discussing on a popular radio station yesterday about the pointlessness of Aston Villa or what they bring to the party. Someone did tweet immediately later going, what's the point of your face? Which we also decided what didn't really have a great point in it. But it must be weird to be a Villa fan when you can beat City and you can beat Chelsea, you can beat Arsenal at the Emirates, was the only side that have done that this season, and then lose 4-1 to Stoke.
Yeah, I can't explain it, except they have, I don't know, they have a lot of young players. They've, for some reason, they can't seem to find any consistency. I don't know why.
Looks like that'll be all right. Barry, you want to say something?
Well, I was going to give you a stat.
Okay, yeah, good.
Because you've been monopolising them. Mm. Peter Odemwingie, who was excellent for Stoke yesterday, has now scored 9 times against either Birmingham, Aston Villa and West Brom.
Wow.
That's a stat, all right.
You don't seem impressed with that.
I almost zoned out, right? To be really honest. Just to mention, yeah, so Palace lost in the last minutes, Newcastle, Hull beat West Brom. Lots of teams still in trouble at the bottom. Got some questions that have been sent in.
Oh, did you see Shane Long's...
Non-celebration.
...wife was in a Twitter spat with various West Brom fans.
Oh, really?
Her husband, who scored against... his old club, but didn't celebrate. And then there was a suggestion he dived to get the penalty from which Hull scored their first goal.
And how did Mrs. Long react?
Well, after the game, Mr. Long and his daughter and possibly his mum were walking to his car, and they were, or Shane Long was abused by a clatter of West Brom fans. So his wife took to Twitter to give out about it, and someone called her a stuck-up cow.
That was a long story, Barry.
When you mentioned Mr. and Mrs. Long, I thought it was a new Roger Hargreaves story.
I've got some questions that have been sent to us. Anko United says, after seeing Skrtel and Agger in short sleeves to Liverpool at the weekend, it started me thinking, are Chelsea the least tattooed team in elite European football?
It's a question I don't know the answer to, but I can perfectly believe it.
Certainly after Morelos left... That was big in tattoo terms for Chelsea.
Big in tattoo terms. But all these kind of... I'd like to think of Matic and Ivanovic, these big, you know, walking mountains, that they're too hard to actually need a tattoo to show how hard they are. Yeah.
Well, there's an implication there that we've seen them all naked and can confirm that they don't have tattoos in places that aren't necessarily visible on
and
the pitch.
And indeed we have.
Ricky, Ricky Lambert, I believe, has a Liverpool tattoo.
Does he? Mm. Do any of you have tattoos?
No.
There's a tattoo.
I don't have a tattoo. I'm looking
Is
forward.
Is that because we're all so hard that we don't need
No, them? I think we're a bit too old to have caught the fashion. And I think the fashion is like in people in their 20s. And I'm really looking forward to the days when they're in their 60s. And I will be 95. But I will look at them and I will go, look at your sagging body covered in ink.
It is. I went out with a girl who had a tattoo. And she was absolutely appalled then... to discover that when David Dimbleby got his tattoo, he got the same one.
Oh, no. Jason asked on Twitter, would you take Ricky Lambert or Andy Carroll to the World Cup? Mark Hughes thinks we should take Peter Crouch. We could take all three and then just play, get some good channel ball fullbacks like Alan Kimball and just knock it up to them.
Do you know what? I think Ricky Lambert has done as good as he could do to make his case. You know, he's had two great seasons in the Premier League. With his feet, I mean, he is better than either of those two strikers, and he's great in the air, great at set pieces. If he doesn't get taken, I'm sure he'd have very good reason to feel aggrieved.
Paul, you say you would build the team around Southampton, sort of a mix of Liverpool and Southampton, I presume.
Absolutely, yeah. Ricky Lambert, although in general, when there's two players of almost similar quality, I'd go for the younger one, just in the interest of future, because England aren't going to win the World Cup this year. But I'd make an exception for Lambert over Carroll, because they're not that similar. He's a much better player.
There was an interesting and thought-provoking article on Football 365 today. I can't remember who wrote it, but whoever did write it said that Lambert's, the way he's used at Southampton and his versatility could stand against him, and that if Roy Hodgson does bring, you know, your classic big man, it will probably be Andy Carroll, but not really through any fault of Ricky Lambert.
I don't know. I mean, there was that Russell Brand was on Match of the Day on Saturday and talking specifically about West Ham, and then he described Andy Carroll there taking down the ball with his customary grace. And he kind of actually does do that, but then the next clip he's kind of trying to chest the ball down to spin and he just chests it 15 yards away from him to the opposition. And I think there's something like Andy Carroll, like in the Euros, he came into really good form for Liverpool at the end of the season, and he's not doing that for West Ham right now, I think it's fair to be said.
Yeah. And the other thing is Ricky Lambert, if penalties do become an issue for England, you can rely on him an issue, yeah.
Right, I think you can go to your meeting, Paul.
Thank
I'm
you very much.
Pretty happy. Thanks,
did
everybody.
Did I do you proud?
Right, we'll read out more feedback. If you'd like to go on the blog and say something nasty, if it's nice, we won't read it out. But if it is rude, it'll probably get read out.
I don't encourage them. They don't need that kind of encouragement.
Cheers, Paul. Thank you very much, nice. Paul Doyle. Appreciate your time. Thanks, Barry. You're back again on Thursday, Barry.
Oh, good.
Alongside Dakin Steinberg and Ian McIntosh. Have a super 3 days.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.